And it's my great pleasure today to introduce Mike White, Chairman, President and CEO of DirecTV, one of the world's leading provider of digital television entertainment. DirecTV currently serves almost 40 million customers in the United States and Latin America. Mike joined DirecTV in January 2010, and as President, Chairman, and CEO, he oversees operations and strategic direction of DirecTV in the U.S. and DirecTV in Latin America. Before joining DirecTV, Mike led PepsiCo International as Chief Executive Officer and as Vice Chairman from 2003 to 2009. Prior to that role, Mike served as President and Chief Executive Officer of Frito-Lay's Europe. And somebody earlier said, are you going to bring any chips with you today? Not today. Mike served in Europe, Africa, and the Middle East division of Frito-Lay. Before joining PepsiCo, Mike was Senior Vice President and General Manager for Avon Products. He also worked as a management consultant for Bain & Company and Arthur Andersen. While Mike's career has taken him to many places around the world, his roots are here in New England as a graduate of BC High and Boston College. Mike also holds a master's degree from Johns Hopkins University, and he was a Ford Foundation Fellow at Leningrad State University. In addition to serving on the DirecTV Board of Directors, Mike is also a director of Whirlpool Corporation. Welcome home, Mike.
Thanks, Bob. It's a real honor and privilege to be here with you today. I'll try to fix my R's and O's because I've been gone from Boston for a little bit, but I did see the sign for Charlestown this morning, so. Listen, it's great to see so many friends from colleagues, former colleagues from Bain come out, some family, friends from BC High, BC, some great partners from the New England Patriots to Nesson. Thank you for being here this afternoon. I'm sure a lot of you have seen some of our fabulous DirecTV commercials, and our head of marketing is here with me as well, as also a BC grad, I might add, including, I assume, perhaps our super creepy Rob Lowe spots, but they wouldn't let me show them today, so I don't have any ads to show you. But anyway, for those of you who aren't familiar, as Bob said, DirecTV is the world's largest pay TV business with more than 39 million subscribers. About half of them are in 10 countries across Latin America. We launched our first satellite about 20 years ago as part of Hughes Communications Company. And DirecTV is now, as of this year, a Fortune 100 company with about $32 billion in annual revenues. By the way, a small shout out for a very good friend and fellow BC alum, Senator Ed Markey, who it turns out was instrumental prior to me being at DirecTV to DirecTV's start when he personally sponsored the original 1988 legislation as a member of the House, which would let satellite companies carry network affiliates and has been so critical to enabling us to thrive all these years. Now, as Bob said, I joined DirecTV and was named CEO actually almost 5 years ago to the day, and I was a complete outsider to the pay TV industry. I was succeeding a guy named Chase Carey, who'd returned to News Corp as Rupert Murdoch's number two a few months prior to my landing. I was inheriting a company that had pretty consistently outperformed the industry. Chase had grown subscribers over 1 million subs a year and had done a great job taking the company from being unprofitable to profitable. So this afternoon, I thought I would just talk a little bit about when you inherit a great company like that, I assumed everything would be smooth sailing. Let me tell you a little bit of how our world has changed over the last 5 years, and I'm going to focus on three things: how we set a new winning strategy for our company amid all of the changes going on around us in our industry. Second, how we went about engaging and aligning our employees, and I'm really passionate about this particular subject to enable us to execute it. And finally, how we've increased our commitment to the community and environmental sustainability, which I think are an integral part of any consumer business in particular, and frankly, any business, it's kind of table stakes in today's world. So first 2 months into the job, literally, I was faced with my first big strategic decision. One board member, and several financial analysts have started writing and strongly lobbying and recommending we spin off our Latin America business into a separate company. After a little bit of strategic analysis, leveraging some of my Bain training, which I got under Mitt Romney in the early 80s, and a trip to the region, I pretty quickly concluded that, in fact, we had an even more strategically advantaged business in Latin America with fewer of the issues that we faced than our U.S. business. And second, it still only scratched the surface on our growth potential. In fact, I felt it was, frankly, our company's best growth opportunity. And you don't typically spin off your best growth opportunity, so I decided not to spin it off, but in fact to double down and aggressively invest capital in Latin America. We were going to do it by focusing on capturing high-end customers, premium customers, by emphasizing our world-class technology and distinctive content. And at the same time, we were going to unlock that growth potential by appealing to the rising lower-income middle class. Now, these are folks who are moving up into what's called the middle class. In countries like Brazil, they make probably $6,000 to $10,000 a year. And we were going to do that with a new, more affordable product, kind of similar to the phone business, a prepaid product. And it's worked brilliantly for us. So that was kind of the first big strategic decision. Now, turning to the U.S., on the surface, the business was performing, as I said earlier, pretty well when I arrived. In fact, DirecTV had always emphasized having the most distinctive content, particularly sports. And I'm particularly appreciative for Jonathan being out here, Jonathan Kraft, with us this morning. He and his dad and the whole Kraft family are great partners and world-class philanthropists and business people. Consumer Reports had long given DirecTV the best ratings for sound and picture. We had led the industry in the adoption of high-definition picture. And we'd beaten cable in service for a decade. So pretty easy job being CEO. What's the problem, you might ask? Well, beginning around shortly after I joined, mid-2010, the U.S. pay TV industry started to change, and change fast. First, the leading mobile providers, AT&T and Verizon, had recently launched a competitive video service, and at the same time were rolling out the nation's first 4G networks, which would greatly facilitate watching video on mobile devices. And it's hard to remember, but in fact, in 2010, tablets like my iPad were just taking off, which also made it easier to watch video on a bigger screen than those smaller mobile phones. In addition, when you looked at the kind of future customer of the world, like my kids, the viewing habits of millennials, ages 18 to 29, were proving to be pretty darn different. They watch a lot less live TV, they undersubscribe to pay TV, and they watch nearly half their shows on the internet, in some ways, mostly on YouTube's non-traditional channels. And finally, our growth at DirecTV had started to slow significantly. And if there weren't that one enough, our cost of content, which, by the way, is the rights that we pay for, and it's about 60% of our cost, started to rise double the rate it had risen under Chase. And it was pretty clear to me that with that kind of pressure on the P&L when you're a distributor was going to force us to increase prices to our consumers well above the rate of inflation, for frankly, as far as I could see. And in fact, by early 2012, the analysts started noticing this as well and were growing more and more pessimistic about the future of DirecTV. In fact, one highly respected analyst wrote, quote, "The bear case for DirecTV is now so familiar it can be recited while sleepwalking. The U.S. business faces rising programming costs without a broadband offset." Another analyst wrote, quote, "Satellite's one-way technology is increasingly out of step, and cable's ability to bundle broadband and video presents an insurmountable pricing challenge to satellite TV." In fact, another website said there's a Game of Thrones level of blood about to be shed, and not everyone's going to survive, particularly satellite. Now, personally, I'm a big believer that sooner or later, all strategies run out of gas. And it seems in this kind of hyper-competitive post-2008 world, mostly sooner. And ours was no exception. So we clearly needed to set a new strategic course if we wanted to continue to outperform our industry. And frankly, setting a strategic direction is job one for any CEO. And in my experience, the process of setting that strategy starts with three things: objectively facing reality while at the same time looking ahead to the future, making a set of focused bets on change, and lastly, if necessary, having the courage to pivot from your own strategy or recalibrate tactics if necessary. So starting first with facing reality, you've got to start with all of it, the good, the bad, and the ugly. You have to get outside the company to talk to customers, to talk to suppliers. You have to constantly scan the horizon and even look outside your industry. It requires looking around the corner. Or as the great Wayne Gretzky once said, skating to where the puck is going to be, not where it has been. You have to carefully study your competitors, and in our case, that meant not only studying competitors like Comcast, the cable company, but also, in this case, non-traditional ones, whether it was Netflix, Google, or Amazon. And in fact, you can't take anything for granted when you clean sheet your strategy. You can't be afraid to challenge the status quo. You have to seek out the truth tellers, both within and outside your company. Now, I also knew we were going to have to embrace three big technology shifts that were occurring: the increasing importance of the internet, mobility, and the cloud. In particular, the sea change confluence of mobility and connectivity was making video content more accessible on more devices in more places than ever. And finally, our industry, to say the least, has a long-standing problem when it comes to customer service. Now, my team felt pretty good because we'd been rated higher than cable for more than 10 consecutive years. But I asked them to show me the rest of the ratings, including other industries. And our industry as a whole was ranked, not surprisingly, among the worst. In fact, only slightly ahead of airline and banking, everybody's favorites. And I felt we could do a lot better. I thought we should be aspiring to build loyalty on a par with great service companies like USAA, Costco, Zappos, and Nordstrom. So to tackle these challenges, we decided to focus on what I call DirecTV's triangle of advantage: having the best product and technology, number one; building a winning customer service that incents loyalty, number two; and having the most distinctive and compelling content. So first, we focused on stepping up our technology innovation game around our product and doing what I said earlier, embracing the internet, cloud, and mobility. We focused on transforming the in-home viewing by improving our user interface, as well as connecting the TV to the internet, which enabled us to unlock thousands of additional movie titles that we could do on demand that we couldn't carry on the satellite. In fact, it was a horses for courses strategy. Use the satellite for what it's best for and supplement it with the internet where that makes sense. We then went ahead and launched the most advanced digital video recorder in the industry, something called Genie. And finally, we aggressively invested in enhancing our .com website and launching a best-in-class TV Everywhere app across all mobile devices. We went from having a basic DVR scheduling app when I started to now being able to stream over 100 channels in the home and more than 50 outside the home, so that any device is now effectively a TV. And we also have on-demand content that we've added from 150 cable networks that we can stream anytime, anywhere. Second, we made a bet on building winning customer loyalty for life. Now, churn is critical in a subscription business. It's the percentage of customers who leave your platform every month, and I was shocked to find out when I got to DirecTV that our annual churn was about 18%. I said, "You mean we lose 18% of our customers a year?" They said, "Yeah, by the way, that's about 1.5% a month, and we're the best in the industry." Now, it's incredibly costly to acquire a new subscriber. In our case, when we sign someone up, we spend $1,000 to wire their home. So earning their loyalty to keep them on the platform, forget the two-year contract, we need them on the platform for 3+ years to ever get a return on that $1,000 investment. So we went about studying why folks were leaving and realized there were a number of things we needed to change at DirecTV. We went ahead and launched the industry's first instant rebates program instead of the 16-step mail-in the rebate thing we had before. We launched the industry's first transparent upgrade program to reward loyalty, similar to the new every two you can get with cell phone carriers. We also went about retraining our entire frontline workforce, more than 30,000 employees, half technicians and half call agents, to think outside the box and solve customer issues. In fact, one of the great ideas we got from techs was when we call on a customer and do a service call, why don't we just automatically change the batteries in their remote? As a result of these changes and so many others, our Net Promoter Score, which was frankly started by a Bain colleague, Fred Reichheld, measures loyalty, has more than doubled. And we now have moved up to number one in our industry on Net Promoter Score, in addition to beating cable 10 years in a row, to have the most loyal customers in the industry, and more importantly, we've begun to close the gap on other best-in-class service companies. And third, we doubled down on having the most compelling content in the industry, from renewing our NFL Sunday Ticket franchise, thanks to the help of Robert Kraft, who chairs the broadcast committee, and adding new digital rights and a fantasy football channel this year, to increasing the ability to watch what we call every single match of every tennis and golf major from multiple angles. We call it kind of the DirecTV mosaics, to producing critically acclaimed original content like Rogue and Kingdom and the Dan Patrick Show and now the Rich Eisen Show as well. In fact, interestingly enough, our audience network, which is our kind of stuff, is in the top 40 networks ranked and gets 6.5 million viewers a week. Content, no doubt, is a powerful differentiator, and we continue to look for ways to even further differentiate our experience. So the good news with this was these three big strategies were working pretty well. Since I'd taken charge in 2010, we'd continue to defy the critics, with both our US and Latin America businesses performing well, growing from about 24 million subscribers or households in 2009 to 39 million this year. Obviously, Latin America contributing a big part of that. We'd increased our revenues by 50%. We'd increased our earnings per share fivefold, leveraging an aggressive share buyback strategy that I put in place in 2010. And all of that worked pretty well to get our stock to grow from $33 a share when I took over to the high 60s late last year. But as I said earlier, as a CEO, you can't take anything for granted, and you have to constantly look around the corner, as I say it. You've got to have the courage to pivot when your strategy either runs out of gas or even has the looks that it might. And frankly, last year, it was becoming increasingly clear to me, as well as my board of directors, that we were going to need something more transformational. In an increasingly internet-driven world, we still don't have our own broadband connection, so we were partnering with others and had a substandard and uncompetitive experience. Content costs were continuing to rise, which is putting more pressure on us to increase prices and contributing to customers being angrier and angrier on that front. We're also a pure play video provider. All we do is TV. Cable, on the other hand, can spread those increasing content costs across three services, video, internet, and the phone. And that's a big differentiator. And we also knew, obviously, internet, not video, was becoming more and more the first criteria in a buyer's purchase decision. In fact, 75% of the subscribers that we lose in that churn metric were going to an internet bundle provider like cable. So as a CEO, shifting strategies in the middle of the river isn't something I take lightly. We looked at every single one of our options, whether it was staying independent, whether it was acquiring spectrum and building out our own broadband network, or a host of other acquisition and merger ideas. In the end, we concluded that an opportunity to merge with AT&T, which is America's second largest broadband provider, was by far the best decision for our customers, our company, our employees, and our shareholders. Interestingly enough, AT&T at the same time was also looking at their video business and concluding that they really needed a world-class video capability with more competitive content costs than they could ever achieve on their own to meaningfully compete in the long term. Now, combining with AT&T will create a much stronger competitor to the dominant cable industry and provide consumers with more options. We think we can unlock an enormous growth opportunity to sell both internet and video to more than half of American homes in AT&T's broadband footprint. That's a huge growth unlock for DirecTV. And AT&T found that capturing synergies with our content cost rate card would enable them to go ahead and build out more high-speed broadband to 15 million new homes, mostly in rural America. They also saw the potential to leverage our content relationships to offer more video on mobile with their 100 million subscriber base. The combined company, we think, is a new and unique competitive alternative. It's a company with complementary capabilities and assets, unlike what either company could do on its own. The horses for courses hybrid strategy really comes alive when you've got 100 million subscribers on a $200 billion mobile network, you've got the satellite net asset base of 15 billion and our 20 million subscribers in the US, and then you've got their broadband capability to service up to 50 million homes. All of that is about leveraging the best of DirecTV satellite technology and content, along with AT&T's growing high-speed broadband infrastructure and their most reliable wireless network. So that's on the strategy front. Turning to engaging employees, look, I know setting a strategy comes first, but I'm a big believer that in today's world, it's execution that matters, and the best plan's gonna fail if you can't get your people passionately behind you to execute. And as much time as I spend thinking about and formulating our strategies and thinking about the future, I frankly spend as much or maybe even more time communicating our strategies to our diverse employee population and trying to provide a supportive environment for them to do their best work. Now, especially as a new CEO, like I was in 2010, you better clearly define your scorecard early on as well as how you get an A. Everyone needs to know what you stand for and what they're going to be held accountable for when the new sheriff arrives. I made it very clear that talent and teamwork, which we call our people agenda, was going to be an integral part of every single leader's accountabilities. I had Stephen Covey lead a session at my first leadership meeting to focus on building trust within our team. And my direct reports and I later even cooked a gourmet dinner together at an offsite in Napa Valley at the Culinary Institute to reinforce the concept of teamwork and collaboration, which I knew was a shock to my wife, who knows too well that I can't cook, but I did make the salad that day. Building alignment, though, starts with trust from the top to the bottom of any organization. My former boss, PepsiCo's CEO, Wayne Calloway, used to say, quote, "They don't care what you know until they know you care." I think that's so true. As a CEO, you have to make leadership personal and show how you care about each and every employee and how you care about the enterprise as a whole. I walked all 40 floors of our LA campus over the first few months, and it did take a few months to get to all of the floors, so I could meet as many of our folks as I could in their workspace. Some of you may know I went on television and did the Undercover Boss show to publicly reinforce how important I felt our frontline employees were to us. I also made it clear to my direct reports that talent was going to be critical. I hired a world-class human resources leader, a guy named Joe Bosch, and had him report directly to me instead of the general counsel, which is where it reported prior to my time. And we defined what we call our leadership formula, which is something like this, a big wheel, that defines the competencies that we expect every employee leader to develop, from business judgment to setting a strategic direction to delivering results, building talent, and doing it the right way. And we use it in our employee review processes company-wide. And finally, in this area, you have to invest in your people. Actions always speak louder than words, so you have to show you're willing to invest in their career development. We started our development strategy with the senior team. It began with a leadership development program modeled after one I had been running at PepsiCo, which is an intensive week-long course that I teach personally along with a couple of other folks. In fact, nearly all 150 vice presidents and above and many of our directors have now gone through the program. We developed similar programs that we call Accelerator and Coaching and Leadership Essentials for people managers all the way down to frontline supervisors. And thousands have been through those programs, and yet every class still seems to be full. The results of all that have been terrific. The DirecTV workforce is more committed than ever. Engagement, which is an important metric for employees' willingness to put their own effort, discretionary effort, into our strategy, is measured each year as part of our annual organization health scorecard. And we've increased it significantly from 77% to 85% since I joined in 2010. And I'm also proud to say we were named to Towers Watson's high-performing companies list 2 years ago, putting us in the top 20 out of 500 companies surveyed annually. Finally, in today's world, I wanted to touch on our responsibility to the community as a business. I know commitment can't stop with your employees and their engagement and development. A respected, successful enterprise also has a responsibility to the community and even the world around it. Leading PepsiCo's international businesses, I came to understand that without a society that thrives and grows socially and economically, your business will not be able to sustain itself. And our employees, particularly the millennial generation, like my kids, demand it in any employer they want to work for and are passionate about. Now, this stuff feels good, but just like anything in business, you have to make it strategic and business relevant if you think you're going to sustain support for it. For us as a technology business, we know that a good science, technology, engineering, and math education is critical for our workforce so that we can compete in the 21st century. So it was natural for us to decide, let's focus our philanthropic efforts on K through 12 STEM education. And in order to get started and focus, we picked working with the inner city, the worst of the inner city LA schools. That happens to be where our headquarters is. We also put a lot of focus on employee volunteerism so we could instill a culture of teamwork, along with elevating a spirit of giving back in the local communities in which we do business. And we built a sustainability agenda around significantly reducing the energy consumption of our set-top boxes and cutting overall waste in our system. Now, as a leader, once you set that corporate social responsibility agenda, you have to also personally sponsor, support, and encourage the efforts. I try to make it a point to attend as many employee volunteer projects as I can, roll up and pitch in where I can. Every one of our leadership offsites, this wasn't a mandate, by the way, it just happened. After we did it one of mine, all of a sudden, it's funny, every functional offsite, from marketing to finance to you name it, featured a volunteer component. Whether it was working with a company called Kaboom to build playgrounds in inner cities, whether it was cleaning and painting a school, even our dealer convention once a year pulls together 700 dealers who wanted to contribute in building playgrounds. We did packing gifts for troops overseas in one, and one marketing, we built bikes for kids in need. Interestingly enough, these have become the most highly rated parts of our various offsites, giving more meaning and purpose to our leaders, and in my opinion, it makes them better leaders. When you have to work in that kind of an environment, you get to better understand the rest of the world, and I think that makes you a more rounded person. Finally, you have to measure results in this area, just like any other area, and we rigorously measure our results in line with something called the Global Reporting Initiative. We also participate in the Carbon Disclosure Project, and we produce a corporate social responsibility report every year to make those results public. And as proud as I am of our business performance, I'm even more proud of DirecTV being named last year to the Bloomberg Civic 50 list of the most community-minded organizations in America. We're also the only Energy Star Partner of the Year in our industry 2 years in a row, as recognized by the EPA. So as a leader, when I step back and look at our business, I'm proud of what we've accomplished as a team. But frankly, I'm even more excited about our future competitiveness and growth potential following our planned merger with AT&T. Now, in closing, the title of my speech was supposed to be From the Heights to Hollywood. That's probably what got you all here. And I know I've mostly talked about kind of the DirecTV journey in Hollywood, but really the journey started at Boston College. Over a nearly 40-year career in business, I've come to understand that in such a fast-changing world, learning doesn't stop with just a diploma in hand. In fact, the most successful people I've met along the way, including 93-year-old Don Kendall, founder of PepsiCo, make learning a lifelong passion and have had countless teachers and mentors along the way. But I have to note that the foundation for my learning and success started with my formal education from some outstanding professors at Boston College. BC allowed me to go to the USSR as a semester exchange student in 1973. Which helped kindle a career-long interest in and curiosity about in other countries, their language, culture, traditions, and people. And my liberal arts education gave me, I think, a unique global and humanist perspective to see and understand both business and the world around me. Boston College's motto, ever to excel, and the study discipline I learned at the Heights reminds me constantly that excellence is a journey, not a destination. And you have to work at it and strive to improve every day, since nothing stands still in this fast-changing world. And the former Jesuit Superior General Father Pedro Arrupe's challenge to be a, quote, man for others, inspires my commitment to be a person who truly cares for others as a leader and to support our company's efforts of giving back to the community around us. It's been an incredible journey, and it all began in 1970, just down the road in Chestnut Hill, so I owe a lot to Boston College. That started my career journey. Thanks for listening. I'd be happy to take any of your questions. Yes.
You spoke enthusiastically about Ed Markey's early role in telecommunications. I wonder to what extent you share now his enthusiasm for the concept of net neutrality.
Well, Senator Markey, I guess I went up in his standing when he found out I was only a BC grad but a commuter. And they don't have those anymore, so take a few to know. But, you know, unfortunately, I think this is a very complicated subject that has been kind of played out in the media in a pretty superficial way. No one believes in blocking websites that I know of in the industry. No one believes in throttling, and everyone believes in transparency. I think the big debate is really over if you're going to have to spend money for the pipes to carry video. And by the way, 50% of the usage of the average internet company in peak hour are two companies, YouTube, Google, and Netflix. And who's going to pay for it? And is the consumer going to pay for it? Or are the broadband providers plus a little bit of money from the Netflixes of the world going to pay for it? And that's the big question. It's a complicated topic. I would tell you the legalisms around it are incredibly complicated. I personally don't think using regulations that were designed for railroads and the phone system in the 1800s and 1930s is a particularly smart way to go. But we'll have to see. And I think it's an important public policy debate. And I'm hopeful that the FCC will come to a sensible decision that won't chill the need to continue to invest in higher speeds and more fiber to have more broadband in this country. Other question? Yeah.
Yeah, I have the mic slide, so I could ask a
sure.
question. On the future of the industry, how do you see the role of the pay TV distribution companies changing in a world where more networks start going over the top and they start launching their own standalone streaming services?
Well, you know, we've looked at the, we're actually launching our own over-the-top Hispanic service called Yaveo later on this year, make sure we get some learning. We took NFL Sunday Ticket this year and did a little bit of over-top to get some learnings in both universities, a couple universities and apartments and cities. Clearly, it's going to change the industry. The challenge of this is everyone kind of immediately assumes it's a technology issue. And frankly, they miss the fact that actually it's a content rights issue and how you're going to monetize that content. So today, between ad sales and affiliate fees that we all pay the media companies, you're talking $140 billion a year. So the over-the-top guys would love to get a piece of that action. Look, I don't have any issue if someone wants to try a Netflix free rider model on the internet. I've looked at it as an option. I looked at acquiring Hulu. But I think the real question is going to be if you start unbundling the content, and you're going to force me to carry these huge bundles that are frankly too big today, but that's what I'm forced to take by the media companies, you know, then pretty quickly distributors are going to say, I don't need to carry that stuff. So interestingly enough, I think it'll have less to do with can I watch stuff on an iPad or on the PC. It's going to actually come back to the content issue. And if you're going to tie my hands and force me to take all these channels and then turn around and do it a la carte over here, I'm going to say, well, give it to me a la carte. I'll be happy to price my service as plumbing and wiring, if you will, because the satellite's an efficient system, and then separate price the content, but I can't today. So we'll see. But I you know, I think you'll see more of it, for sure. And Netflix has done a great job. Yeah?
They don't like the cable companies or the satellite companies because they watch 10 networks and they have to pay for 90 of them that they never watch. And whether
right.
that's a reality or perception, that's how consumers feel. So then you have HBO that announced with great fanfare that they are going to allow you in 2015 just to subscribe to HBO. CBS, Moonves follows suit, says CBS is going to allow the exact same thing. This has got to have huge ramifications for the satellite companies and the cable companies. So I have two questions. A, do you think that's good for consumers or bad for consumers? And what does that mean for DirecTV moving forward?
Again, I think you're mixing apples and oranges here. So I would love, I mean, I'd be happy to price my content a la carte. I'm not allowed to. It's not my decision to stick you with 200 channels. Every negotiation, and we have about 200 of them a year with the content companies, is not just a rate card, but it's also mandates how much I have to sell that service to how many of my households, and it's usually 80%. So I have my hands tied, and I've argued for this. I argued about the Dodgers to get it a la carte. I've argued about you know, the Pac-12 to be a la carte because it's taxing everybody, including consumers in New England, which is crazy. Unfortunately, that's where our industry is right now, and I don't see the content companies changing. Now, each of those are two different topics. I mean, CBS is not going to have the NFL, and therefore, my prediction is it ain't going to be a big home run. Okay, I think HBO is already a la carte at DirecTV and all the distributors, where you can take it or not take it, and as long as they don't undercut the price, I don't have a problem with them selling it a la carte. In fact, Richard Plepler told me he wants to partner with DirecTV, and what they're really trying to do is get at the millennials that are renters, there's about 10 million of them, and that aren't taking pay TV today, and so I would love to find a way to get a smaller bundle working together with the media companies that we could kind of sell in a smaller bundle, you know, to those consumers. That's really the opportunity, and we all would like to see that because we want to participate as millennials change the world. Yep.
Hi, Mike. Really interesting. Different topic. I have to ask what we're all wondering, which is, did you approve that creepy Rob Lowe ad, and how's it doing?
Well, you know, I've kind of come to realize that in marketing land, if I kind of look at and approve everything, you don't get the creativity you'd like out of the team. And I trust their judgment, so, you know, I sometimes kind of, they'll come to me and I'll say, you know, and sometimes there's more of a story there, but you got to remember, you're probably not our target audience. Our target audience for that ad was males, you know, 25 to 35, college educated, who love sports, so anyway. Yes, been great PR for us, though.
Regarding the satellite ISP service, where is the technology on that? Where do you see the satellite ISP technology? And when do you think it might be commercially viable?
Yeah, so I like to say, first of all, let's talk satellite literally. Like we have 14 satellites in the sky over the U.S. You know, satellites are great for two things. They're great for broadcast, one to many, and they're great for spying. To be honest with you, they will never be great for two-way stuff. So we used to own, I don't know what HughesNet is called today, but we used to own it, we spun it off. It's just not an optimal way to compete with fiber, or either whether it's fiber to the node or fiber to the home, and I don't think it ever will be. So, you know, our view on broadband or internet is satellite is never going to get there, and that's part of the reason I made the judgment that I couldn't find another way to solve that than partnering up with a broadband company, and in this case it was AT&T. So, now, we do think with AT&T, we could use the satellite for video, because video is a big heavy load of bits, and then use the internet, and we'll get faster speeds on the internet. And then you connect the box, which we've already done, 6-7 million of our subscribers, where you connect it to the internet, and then I can pull from the internet the edge or fringe stuff, and I can use the mainstream stuff. We push a lot of stuff into your box you don't even know about, so that when you hit the button for a movie or whatever, it's there. It's enabled us to do 100,000 titles. So. But I don't see kind of satellite per se as being the solution for broadband. Never say never in technology land, but not as far as I can see. Anything else? Great. Well, I really appreciate everybody coming out today. Happy Thanksgiving.